what the compression ratio is. If you increase the air pressure coming in higher than 1 atm, you could actually, the volumetric efficiency of that cylinder is going to increase. Yes, it's going to require more fuel because more power is going to be delivered, but the overall efficiency of that cylinder, depending on the camshaft at what RPM it's at, the overall efficiency of the engine will increase, Dick. And it doesn't matter whether it's a turbo or a supercharger. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
The laws are different, Glenn. Go ahead, Eric. Back pressure as opposed to a direct coupling, there's different equations for both of them. So turbo is actually more efficient than supercharger in that sense. But then again, if you're on the racing circuit and using nitrous, then you're going to go super because you can afford that energy loss that you're working with.
Now, I'm having a little bit of a problem here. In the case of a turbocharger, I'm extracting some of the energy out of the exhaust gases to turn the turbine to do the extra compression of the air that's going into the carburetor. In the case of a supercharger, I'm taking the mechanical energy out of the crankshaft, running through a bunch of bolts and gear shafts and whatever, and with Roots type compressors, I'm again putting excess air pressure into that carburetor. So whether I take the energy out of the exhaust gases for running the turbocharger, or whether I take the mechanical energy out of the crankshaft to run the supercharger, is one in an overall package, is one of those processes mechanically more efficient than the other? What do you think, Eric?
Well, think about the losses and where the losses occur, okay? Don't forget, internal combustion engine is not that efficient. A lot of it is wasted as heat. A lot of it is wasted in the whole exhaust process of an auto cycle engine. And that makes the cycle engine different, by the way, and its losses are in a different place. So, yeah, we're talking small differences here, but you'd rather steal that energy from the long process of the combined output of all the cylinders pushing the gas through into the muffler. Don't forget your muffler has a certain amount of back pressure that you are required to have things operate smoothly, and you can replace that with a turbo and use that energy instead of throwing it out as heat.
KCQIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, in some applications, especially for like a street-driven automobile, not a racing engine, but definitely on street-driven automobiles, the turbochargers definitely have an advantage because of energy recouped. And the thing that's happening there is if you look at the equation for horsepower and what it actually takes to create it, exhaust flow, as many people will tell you, oh, you put headers on your car and your gas mileage is going to go up. There is no direct equation of horsepower or efficiency with exhaust flow. It's basically just temperature. What used to happen with older engines were that when the exhaust was not free-flowing enough, the combustion chamber temperatures would increase. That would put the engine outside of its energy curve, and by reducing the exhaust flow pressure, they were bringing the engine temperature down lower, and they would get more horsepower. But realistically, if you design the engine correctly and have the correct cooling in the heads and everything else, and you were to draw the energy from the exhaust gas flow, you can actually increase more horsepower without having to rob it directly from the crankshaft. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
You got it right on.
Many of us have experienced a condition where our automobile on a rainy day seems to run better. The high humidity injected into the carburetor seems to help. And I guess water injection into a carburetor works along those lines. And the water itself, I presume, stays as a atomized, aerosol. And until it gets into the cylinder and burned, and now it turns into a high-pressure steam-like gas, I'm now getting extra horsepower out of it. So I think water injection can be beneficial if done correctly. What's your guess as to why more of our modern-day automobiles with computer controls are not using water injection, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
KC2QIQ with an answer on that one.
Let me just point out something, Dick. We don't use carburetors anymore. I mean, you know, you're still thinking eons ago. today's cars are pretty much, you know, all fuel injected. And consider water as something that water in the form of water puts fires out. So, go ahead, Glenn.
Actually, Dick, there's a plus and a minus to water injection. And back in the days, like Eric is saying, with carburetors, there was a problem where you, the way that the air and fuel mixture were optimized was with a little jet, a Venturi, and a valve. Basically, that you were opening up down called the butterfly, where you control the airflow. We call it the gas pedal, but it's really the airflow pedal. And basically, the air-fuel mixtures were all over the place. And the problem is that if you got the car to run at one certain RPM, you were either lean in another place, and there were other issues. So certain people found out when cars got leaned out, when the emission standards started, they started adding water, and it actually helped some of the atomization inside the combustion chamber. Let me let it drop for a second. But today we have much better control. We have electronic fuel injection systems. We can control the air-to-fuel ratio mixture, which is actually optimized somewhere around 14 parts of fuel to one part of air, which actually gives you a very, very good gasoline engine for a very, very efficient burn in the engine. And you can control that. When you need a little bit more power, you can change that ratio to 11 parts of air to one part of fuel. So it gets a little bit richer in that condition. But because when you burn water inside there, there's not only parts per million of hydrocarbons that you have to worry about your emissions, but you also have to worry about the CO2 output. And the problem is if you start adding water and you add that hydrogen oxygen inside there along with that, it's going to actually increase your CO2 output. So for emissions, it wouldn't be a good idea, and it might clog up your catalytic converter. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay. Even though we don't have a carburetor anymore, we still have a butterfly that controls the airflow, which is one of the determining factors for what is the RPM of the engine at this time.
The Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Now, don't forget, you have a mass airflow sensor that drives the computer that drives another valve in terms of how much air gets into the cylinder.
Okay, so I've got a butterfly that I have direct connection, in many cases, to the gas pedal. And the computer knows where the setting of that butterfly is, how much air is going to the engine. He therefore also controls the pulse width modulation going into the fuel injectors so that the right fuel-air mixture is being injected into those cylinders. Once I have that degree of control, a fuel-air mixture versus specific pressure, in other words, as I'm using the engine at idling speed, that intake manifold is running at partial vacuum, and I've slowed down the gas flow by way of the fuel injection. Now that I've got that control of mixture, is there any further benefit that I get from water injection? Glenn first, KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Let me point something out.
Go ahead, Eric.
Your description is almost accurate. Really, there's two things that's going on. It's demand, and there's also a preloaded table in the computer. The computer actually, for any given RPM, will have preset values which the auto manufacturer has determined to be the optimum, not only the amount of air, the amount of fuel, also the dwell angle at that particular given moment, all based upon the oxygen sensors that are in the exhaust pipe. So it's really a more complex issue. When you slam down on the throttle, which is really nothing more than an optical sensor or potentiometer these days, that sends a command to the computer and says, hey, I want more energy. I want higher RPM. And then it goes to the next point of the lookup table and says, oh, you want to go here. It'll actually go to those values and then adjust accordingly based upon what the oxygen sensor says.
Hey, let me check this out with you now, Eric. On many automobiles, I thought I still have reasonable tight coupling between the linkage of the butterfly mechanism and my gas pedal. The way you're talking right now is my gas pedal is really an electronic steer-by-wire type thing. It really is a shaft encoder, which is determining the amount of driver demand for horsepower out of that engine. So I'm adjusting the demand by way of my gas pedal. I think you're telling me that the modern-day automobile, it then chooses the right butterfly setting and the right fuel injection pulse duration modulation to make the right engine parameters. So I think you're telling me I'm no longer controlling directly the butterfly. That's now computer control. I'm only determining demand by way of that shaft encoder connected to the gas pedal. Is that approximately true? Over to you, Eric, KQRIW.
Yes, that is the current generation of vehicles. The past generation of vehicle, which they've made the transition from, I guess, in the past 5 years or so, where you actually had linkage to the butterflies, which then would feed the intake manifold. But if you look carefully on the butterfly, there was either an optical sensor or a potentiometer to send the position information back to the computer, which still operates from the lookup table. So, yeah, they removed the linkage part between the butterfly and it's now a servo. But essentially, even in the past generation, if you had a vehicle which has its fuel injection controlled by a computer, so, you know, looking in the last 10 years, the last 20 years, let's see, the Explorer that I had was a, 89. That didn't have the sophistication of what we have today, but it still had the lookup tables, it still had the remote sensor from the butterfly or the throttle. But all that's gone today.
Yeah, in the case of my 1999 Camry, I think it is, I believe I have a mechanical linkage. The more modern cars, you're saying, there's no longer, it's only a servo. With that lookup table, with that ideal setting now of fuel-air mixture for that particular demand in horsepower, with that now modern control, is there any further benefit that happens from water injection, HOH injection, any other kind of injection? Is there any further benefit before I start adding turbochargers and superchargers? Over to you, Eric, KQRIW.
Pass it on to Glenn, but because it was really his turn. In terms of the HHL, or Brown's gas, or let's call it a combustible gas, and stop using the term water, okay, because it's not water vapor what we're talking about. We're talking about, you know, 2 units of hydrogen, 1 unit of oxygen, in a free state is as water. We're not talking about that. We're talking about, you know, atomic hydrogen, which would be H2, and atomic oxygen, which doesn't exist as O, it only exists as O2. So, yeah, there is an advantage, but is that advantage enough in terms of is it worthwhile to put that in a vehicle? As gasoline gets over $4 and $5 a gallon, then I think the answer will be yes. Even if you're getting a 15% or a 20% improvement in mileage, then it becomes worthwhile. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, unfortunately, Dick, in any modern car right now, it would be more negative to add water than it would be positive and then create the ionization inside the combustion chamber. There's two emissions that are governed right now. One is parts per million of hydrocarbon. The other one is CO2. Basically, if you can control your air mixture, your ignition timing, and fuel flow, and over the map of RPM and load power, you can basically do a pretty good job with parts per million. Let me let it drop for a second. And that pretty much, you know, takes care of your hydrocarbons. And now the other problem is that you have the CO2 you got to try to meet. Well, if you start adding water inside there, the only real compensation that basically these automobiles have been using since like the 70s is an EGR. And basically the EGR valve takes exhaust gas and feeds it back into the input, into the intake manifold again, and re-burns it. And this way you can reduce the CO2 content in the exhaust. If you start adding, you know, water back into the input again, your CO2 levels are going to jump to the moon. You'll never pass it. Any of those standards for CO2. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Glenn, don't forget that Eric is not talking about water. He mentioned it so many times. You have HHO, Eric, pick up.
Same thing, Wesley. Same problem.
The EGR is taking the exhaust gases and passing them back into the intake manifold for another chance at burning. Why must that be recycled? Why was it not properly burned in the first place, Glenn?
Well, it's not that it they're not doing it to reburn. It's doing that, but the reality is you have CO2 output that's coming from a hydrocarbon engine. When you're burning hydrocarbons, one of the byproducts in that output is going to be CO2. The catalytic converter will take care of parts per million of hydrocarbons. You can control that any other way, but how do you reduce the CO2? CAD isn't going to do it. The only thing that's going to do it is basically you've got to take some of that hydrocarbon back in and reburn it a second time to reduce the CO2 output.
Let me take this.
I got something to say about that.
Yeah, I got a problem with this. There is carbon in the fuel. When carbon is mixed with oxygen, you're going to get CO2. How can we avoid that? Eric, first, go ahead.
With an EGR valve, and it's the only way.
You still got carbon, and it's still being combined with oxygen. Where the hell is the carbon going?
The whole idea is to create as complete combustion as possible. Don't forget that when you have a slow-burning fuel, you put it under pressure, and as the expansion occurs, the reaction gets killed. You still have volatile molecules there that are going out into the exhaust, and the whole idea is to bring them back into the intake and burn the rest of the unburnt fuel. Just think of it as unburnt fuel, although you're asking where unburnt fuel comes from. There's a lot of physics involved in that.
Okay. I've got a given amount of carbon per gallon of gas. The only way I can have the carbon give me as much energy as it can and come out of that engine, it's going to come out as carbon dioxide. Now, if there's carbon monoxide due to incomplete combustion, I can see feeding that back and making it carbon dioxide. But how can you get rid of carbon dioxide when you've got a given amount of carbon that is being oxidized? I don't know who should take that one.
It's my turn, isn't it?
Go ahead. You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, one of the byproducts, when you take gasoline and you run it at anywhere, and here's the funny part about it. If you keep on increasing the fuel mixture, okay, what basically will happen is the CO2 is going to go down and the parts per million go up. So if you look at the actual parts per million of hydrocarbons, by increasing the fuel ratio, in other words, if you go from 14 to 1, 14 parts to 1 part of fuel, air-fuel mixture, you're going to wind up with a really high CO2 level. You go to 11 to 1, like when you're flooring it, you'll have a very, very high parts per million of hydrocarbons, but you can handle that in the catalytic converter. The problem is when you hit that mid-throttle level and you start getting back to 14 parts per 1, if you, by taking some of the exhaust gas and bringing it back in again, now you're mixing air and carbon dioxide and parts per million and running it through a second time. And what it basically does is it reestablishes the air-fuel mixture at that mid-throttle level to a point of that actually is less efficient in terms of air-fuel mixture. So in other words, it thinks that the air-fuel mixture isn't 14 to 1 anymore. It thinks it's like 12 or 11 to 1, but you're doing it with less fuel. So this way you can reduce the CO2 and at the same time keep the parts per million low. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
When I take the hydrocarbon fuel called gasoline and put it through this internal combustion engine, and if I start off naively only looking at carbon molecules that are in the original fuel,
you know, I want to stop all of you.
Will the carbon come out as anything but carbon dioxide?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what's the purpose of a catalytic converter, Glenn?
Basically what it's doing is it's changing, it's converting the hydrocarbons directly into air and water, and what's the other one? You probably already know, Eric. It's not on the top of my head. Back to you, Eric, KC2QIQ.
The whole idea is to get rid of the nitrogen, yeah?
Yes, it is. That's correct.
So, you know, you're making, you want to get rid of the nitrogen oxide and turn it into just nitrogen and oxygen?
That's correct.
So, I'm slowly getting the impression that the nitrogen is the bad guy, not the carbon. If each carbon molecule that's in the fuel, when properly consumed, is going to turn into carbon dioxide, isn't the given amount of carbon dioxide per liter of fuel, isn't that a near constant on an efficient process? So, when we say we're eliminating carbon dioxide and we're eliminating hydrocarbons, I'm confused here. Isn't the carbon going to be turning into carbon dioxide? I don't know who should pick this up.
That's right, Dick. You're taking carbon monoxide. You're also making carbon dioxide, but the idea is to remove the nitrous compound because we're talking about an organic fuel that's very nitrogen-based.
Are you telling me there's nitrogen in the petrochemical fuel?
When combined in combustion, yes.
Absolutely.
Was there nitrogen in the fuel as it came out of my gas tank?
Let's put it this way. Dinosaurs were made out of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. All living things have those four elements.
Right on.
Right on.
So you're telling me there's a significant amount of nitrogen in the fuel itself. It's not coming from the air that I mix with it. It's in the fuel itself.
That's correct.
To increase the fuel ratio mixture, the nitrogen goes up and the CO2 goes down. CO2 is only a problem, Dick, when you wean out the engine.
Okay. If I'm burning a given amount of fuel, which has a given amount of carbon, how does the carbon come out as anything but carbon dioxide?
Okay. Let's just go back to the catalytic converter. Catalytic converter is two different catalysts. One is a reduction catalyst to take care of the nitrogen. The other is an oxidation catalyst to take care of the carbon monoxide.
Okay. The way Glenn has been wording it, I want carbon dioxide to go down. I think I want carbon dioxide to go up. If I'm completely oxidizing the carbon, I'm going to be getting carbon dioxide. Where am I wrong on that?
Because there's two things you have to meet, Dick. You have to meet the parts per million and all of that and the CO2. They're two different measurements.
Now, the parts per million is in CO, not CO2. The end result of the catalytic converter is CO2, which is not considered to be as bad.
They're both regulated.
I can certainly see eliminating CO, a dangerous gas. But I'm having trouble eliminating CO2.
There is no need to CO2 to be eliminated. It's needed for the plants to actually live alive.
Yeah, CO2 is the result of the catalytic converter in terms of the oxidation catalyst. And a typical chemical reaction is two molecules of CO plus oxygen. It's just two molecules of CO2.
It's KC2, QIQ.
You are doubling.
I stepped on you. Somebody go first. Go ahead, Glenn.
No, I think I've already said my piece here. It's just that nobody believes. Over to you, Herc. KC2, QIQ.
All right. Look. Catalytic converters do two things, right? They give it a nitrogen, all right? The first stage of the catalytic converter, I think, uses platinum and rhodium. I know it uses platinum because I've cut them out to get the platinum out of it. That actually takes, I believe, nitrous oxide and adds, what does it do? It actually separates it. It frees the oxygen, right? And it allows you to have nitrogen instead of nitrous oxide. That's the output. The output is nitrogen and oxygen. Thank you. The oxidation catalyst, if you have two molecules of carbon monoxide and you add oxygen to it, you wind up with two molecules of carbon dioxide.
There's some fairly exotic chemistry that's added to our fuels down here on Long Island. When I used to travel to Utica every weekend, and when I bought fuel in Utica, I got a hell of a lot more mileage out of the fuel in Utica than I do from the fuel on Long Island. Have they finally settled whether or not the additives, 5, 10 years ago, were really beneficial? Are we still doing it? And is it worth doing when it lowers the mileage? I don't know who should take that one, K2LIW.
Well, we add two things these days. We add MBTE, which is really nasty, and we also in the winter, we use ethanol. We had, I think, is it 8% or 10% ethanol? Anybody know?
And you said in the winter. Does that mean in the summer we stop doing it, or we change the ratio?
I believe in the summer we stop doing it.
Now, ethanol is a much lower energy fuel than the petrochemical. Are we still getting a benefit out of using it?
No, the oil companies are getting a benefit out of using it. We don't.
I have the impression that when you take a corn product and you put on the fertilizer and you do all of the harrowing and everything else you do with machinery, that the total fuel cycle for making ethanol out of corn, I'm getting the impression that that whole cycle is negative in benefit. Should we, if we look at the big picture, do you think we should still keep doing it?
If you look at the big picture, we should get rid of internal combustion engines and go to, you know, some other form, like electricity generated by solar and wind and maybe even nuclear, even though I'm not a big fan of that, and move on to electric cars. I mean, battery technology is getting better.
Yeah, we do have a lot of people out of work, and I'm very unhappy about the fact that they're not doing good works right now by generating a whole lot of wind generators and solar voltaics and whatever. If this is the best of all worlds, why aren't we creating more renewable energy, Eric? Go ahead.
No, that's all about politics, okay? And I don't know if we want to go there because I can really get on my, I can get on a platform for that one. I mean, the people that we have running this country are beholden to these large multinational corporations that don't give a crap about us. They only care about, you know, expanding their world and creating jobs and new and upcoming markets. And, you know, they really don't care about the United States of America. They don't even bother to pay taxes. So, you know, they complain that, you know, oh, the taxes are too high. I don't even want to go there because then it, you know, it's just going to be like, you got to put soap in my mouth.
Okay. I think we've gone far enough for tonight. We're not going to settle all these issues, obviously. We're slowly getting a little bit smarter. We're making some mistakes.
Let me take a minute.
Go ahead, Wesley.
Well, the biggest problem with HHO was that the amount of gas that is needed to reach the efficiency of the gasoline was insufficient in production of HHO to run the engine. So, theoretically, if we were able to achieve the production of HHO from water, we wouldn't have a problem with carbon monoxide, we wouldn't be having a problem with the pollution, we would have a pure water. And the problem with that is that the construction of the engine right now is kind of unfriendly to that. So, would that be that all of the politics that is going around was done on purpose with all of the changes for the past 15 years to the engine? That I don't know. But I would like to thank you very much, Eric, for his comments. It's very much valuable. And even though that I might be wrong and he might be wrong, I would say I've got from the discussion that he was the most challenging the subject. Eric, pick up.
Hi, I'm going to leave you with it. There's a guy by the name of Shevsky, and he's the guy who actually invented the nickel metal hydride batteries, and he is the guy that came up with these different formulations. He also started a company called Ovonics. They make solar cells that are in the form of the roofing shingle. You know, it's not the traditional glass anamorphic type of, like regular roofing shingles. You can pop nails through it. But he developed a bottle, and all the automotive companies use them. Everybody has hydrogen ICE engines, hydrogen internal combustion engines, where, again, because a hydrogen molecule is so small and doesn't have the kind of density that you need to carry something without it being under high pressure to have a volume or liquefy it, you know, internal combustion engines are practical to run on hydrogen. We have them now. They're easy to convert. The only problem is, I mean, is the problem of carrying fuel. He developed a metal hydride type of container where it absorbs the hydrogen, releases the hydrogen as it's needed. But still, let me let it drop. If you guys go do a Google search for Ovonics, the name of the company, he did this over 25 years ago, after we covered it with Inova. They did Inova, I think, about 10 years ago. I think you saw that, this one, Dick. It was Oshevsky and his wife. But his wife had recently passed away, I think, a year or two ago. I'm not sure if he's still alive, but he started this company. And the bottle that he created that stores the hydrogen at low pressure because it absorbs into the metal hydride takes up the whole trunk, and it only gets you about 150 miles, so, you know. But the ultimate way of dealing with having no output other than water is not going to be with an internal combustion engine, because you still have oil, you still have stuff sliding by the walls of the cylinder. It's fuel cell. There's a guy out in California who is a NASA scientist who developed the Stirling engine that they use in the Pioneer, and he did a lot of work on fuel cell. 60 Minutes did a big thing on him last year. He's using regular, very common materials to create these very high-efficiency PEM cell-type membrane fuel cell, and now almost 60 or 70% of Google operates from these fuel cells being supplied by natural gas. So there you go. K2RW, K2J.
Yeah, I think the country of Iceland is using hydrogen-powered vehicles. And I think the problem with hydrogen is you don't get quite as much energy density in the usual way of containing it as a compressed gas, or maybe with this catalytic Ovechinsky thing. What's your guess, Eric, as to the number of miles of range I can get out of a hydrogen-powered vehicle? My petroleum-powered vehicle, on a good day, will go 450 miles before I have to refuel it. What do you think I'm going to get out of a hydrogen-powered vehicle? And we would have to reestablish an extremely large infrastructure in order for the so-called gas stations to be ready to give me hydrogen for refueling. Over to you, Eric.
Okay. Iceland, or I can't pronounce it, whatever the capital city is, they have something unique, okay? By the way, there's a lot of Mercedes hydrogen-burning vehicles. There are quite a few fuel cell-based vehicles. Problem with PEMS fuel cells is they wear out. Most people aren't aware of that. Because the PEM membranes themselves degrade after time. They generate their electricity for free. So, you know, Shell created this big electrolysis station which plugs into the grid, and the grid, of course, is plugged into all the geothermal energy that's spitting out of the ground, and it becomes very efficient. And I think now, I think the last I looked was maybe about 6 months ago, more than a third of the country is using either fuel cell-based cars or hydrogen-based cars. But, you know, the country's not that big, they don't have to go that far, but even with a Shevsky's bottle and a fuel cell car, you can probably get 300 or 400 miles out of it.
I'm amazed that that's that much, and I would tolerate that. Up till now, many of the electric vehicles had a very tough time, the purely electric vehicles, not the hybrids, the purely electric vehicles. I think the majority of them didn't get to 100 miles of range. Is that approximately true from your recollection, Glenn? I mean, Mel, here we go. Eric.
Now, the Nissan Leaf that's being sold now, which is an electric car, I think the last I saw, I gotta look it up, I think it's 120 miles or 150 miles, I forget.
Okay, it's probably got regenerative braking, and is it a full-size vehicle or is it a very light vehicle? What kind of protection do I have in a collision?
It's your average, it's a little bigger than a subcompact. It's not like the smart car. You know, there's an electric smart car out there. I wouldn't want to be, although if I were in Europe, I wouldn't have a problem with it. Here, I would have a, I'd have a big problem with it. I mean, it's all over Europe, all over France, all over England, smart cars have been the thing. And don't forget, they don't make trucks the same size that we make them either, though. But, yeah, the Leaf is it's a little bigger than a subcompact, but it's not the compact size, but it's got good integrity from what I've read.
Glenn, are you thinking of buying an electric vehicle?
Well, I'd like to, but I'm waiting for the price to come down, Dick. Actually, I like those Teslas over there in Northern California, but a little too pricey for me. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Doesn't it require about 500 pounds worth of batteries to power an electric vehicle? And in an accident, isn't that an awful lot of mass to account for?
Point is, like, yeah, you wouldn't have all that weight.
I say that one again, Eric.
I think it has about the highest power density of all the batteries that are out there to date. But the problem with Think Air is you can't charge them up. You have to replace the element.
So Zinc Air has got the highest energy density, but it's not rechargeable. Are there any better rechargeables than lithium ion, lithium polymer?
Well, I was talking to one guy who actually works for Ford. You know, I asked him, well, where are you guys making your batteries these days? Where's the R&D for that? You know, is it in Detroit? You know, is it in where you got everything else? I said, no, it's in South Korea. And they're doing these lithium vinyl type things now that have a reduction in weight and an increase in power density.
K-E-Y.
Yeah, I'm going to turn it over to Mel in a minute. By way of carbon nanotubes, we get a lot of area, a lot of surface area out of the conducting devices you put on the plates. Doesn't that also give a higher possibility of energy density? I think you were discussing that earlier. Eric first, and then you pass it over to Mel.
Now, the concept of any kind of carbon nanotubes or buckyballs or whatever you want to call them, I mean, you can make transistors out of the darn things and diodes now. It's an emerging technology. I mean, it was discovered by accident by, taking a microscope and looking at the carbon oxide and discovering these little tubes. So, but it's becoming a more highly developed technology. You'd give it a little time.
You've got it, Mel.
Out last week in the automobile section of the Sunday Times, they reviewed the new Chevy Volt, that EV vehicle, and they gave it a pretty good write-up. They said if you're, a reasonable driver, you'll go 50 miles on the charge, the initial charge of the battery. It plugs in, you can plug it in your garage, and charge it up through a regular outlet. And the battery, they said, however, the battery, of course, General Motors, believe it or not, purchased the battery, $10,000. Going to give you a 10-year, they said, guarantee on the battery. And the battery weighs 430 pounds. It's a nice old vehicle, peppy and everything. And it's got a gas tank that's a little over 9 gallons. And they did a run with it, the reviewer. And they said they were able to go about 500 miles with the, gas. It's all, of course, the motors, the gasoline engine is strictly a charging device, Dick, over.
So if I understand you correctly, 50 miles on the electricity, but it's a hybrid vehicle, and so the internal combustion engine is really is a charging device for the battery. And there, one tank full of gas, 500 miles. Pretty nice. Would you consider it a heavy enough vehicle to give you reasonable crash protection in the American environment?
No, it's perfect for that. Also, the internal combustion engine is directly connected to a generator. There's no mechanical connection to the wheels at all.
Okay. From your impression of that article in the Sunday Times last Sunday, Mel, do you think that vehicle is sufficiently robust that it's reasonable to drive it on American roads?
Let me tell you something. The about the cars. I've seen some cars in accidents, cars high-end like Lexuses and Mercedes. They're plastic. They're all plastic. I saw a little bang. I mean, it was a bumper, and the bumper fell off. That's it. This is the way they're made. These cars are, as they use the expression, meant to give, to save the occupants, but the car just disintegrates to some extent. I don't think there's anything you know, with cars today. Yet, in a test they did last year, very unusual test, they took an old car from the, I guess the 60s, but 60s, 70s, on an old Chevy or a Buick, an Oldsmobile, or whatever, Chrysler, and they put it into an accident, a front end crash with one of the new vehicles of, considered like a sedan. And they said the survival in the newer vehicle is greater than any of the cars produced back like the old days, take over.
Yeah, I believe that. So when it comes to survivability of the passengers and the driver, that has been increased significantly. But I think they've now made the energy absorption crushability of the vehicle do that energy absorbing that's protecting the passenger compartment. Therefore, the vehicle itself, I am going to guess, got more damaged. The modern vehicle got more damage than the older one, whereas the older one subjected the passenger or the pilot to much higher G-forces. Therefore, he was injured. Is that approximately what you remember from it, Mel?
Exactly. The impact with that engine up front, you know, with transmission and rear drive and, you know, the conventional system compared to a newer car, definitely. These cars are meant, like they said, just, yes, junk them, disintegrate, but the passengers is the importance. Cars easily, like they say, replaceable, not the human being, so that's where it's aimed at. Now, you mentioned about the, you know, impact involving the new car, like a battery-driven EV vehicle, I should say, the Volt. You know where they stuck the battery? In the middle, in the console. The battery is fashioned in the shape of that console. The battery is actually sitting between the two front passengers, extending backwards, Dick, over.
I wonder if the study really indicates that that's the safest place to be in a crash situation. Okay, I've got to get up early tomorrow. I'm going to leave you guys. We're not going to end all these things, but we're slowly getting a little bit smarter. 73, you all. This was TechNet number 1330 of the numbering system that I'm using. Our numbers are a little bit low, but it's in the right ballpark. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. Mel, why don't you put some Tyson ribbons on this? K2KEY. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, interesting as always, sitting here and doing my homework and listening at the same time. And, I wouldn't get into the education nor the investment here in this country for alternate energies and things that should be done and all. Believe me, very bad subject, very, very, very bad situation. It's ridiculous what's happening in this country, so can't even get into that. Every aspect, like we talk about the education levels and things and other aspects of industry and all, forget it. It's just outrageous. Anyhow, everybody, I hope you have a healthy and happy new year, and we'll try to continue doing it. it's interesting and it's a great way to spend Sunday night. 73s, everybody. Take care. Thank you very much. This is K2KEY. Good night, all.
Mel, I just realized that I'm going to be seeing Kay Craigie, the president of ARRL, next Sunday at Ham Radio University. Is there any way we can give her a little more information about your, let me call it electronic steering, of your full-wave loop antenna? She and her husband have just established a full-wave loop antenna, and they don't know anything about this common mode versus differential mode electronic steering. Is there any way we can give them any more information on that? I think they'd like to have it. It's not a demand, but it'd be a nice thing if it was possible. What do you think?
I'll let them take a listen, first of all, to the amateurradio.tv. We sure did quite an extensive discussion in the past on it, so I'm sure if they listen to that, it's fairly straightforward. We have covered it, I think, in as much entirety as possible. And anything further on it, then surely you can give me a call or, you know, send me an email, gate2key, like everybody else, arrl.net, and I'll be more than glad to give any explanations or whatever. I'd like to get to that, but I'm still a little bit problems with traveling and all, so looks like I'll still be tied down for a while. I don't know. Hopefully, this I fit, get out of this situation, but I really can't drive these days, Dick. That's really a major problem in my life, over.
Yeah, I think your physician has told you not to drive. And is that likely to persist for a while? And by the way, yes, the amateurradio.tv has a lot of information about your full-wave loop, but unfortunately it's scattered over quite a number of different weeks. And to my knowledge, that has not been put together as one package. And that's too much of a command, I know, for anybody to do that. Your physician has told you he recommends you not drive. Do you think that's going to stay for a while? Over to you, Mel.
I really don't know. You know, I was at the doctor, two weeks ago, on a Monday, in fact, and I took an ultrasound test, and he says, how much you'll heal, you know, what's the healing, we don't know. It's just going to take time. You can't really evaluate it, but I surely feel it. This is my major problem. I can't sit for long periods of time. If I get behind the wheel of the car, and, you know, I drive short distances, go to the supermarket, go to the doctor's office, things like that. I sit about 15, 20 minutes, and whether it be in a chair in a radio room or by the kitchen here or in the car, I'm really become extremely uncomfortable. Feels like, literally like I'm tightening a belt too much around my waist. Like it's something in there just pressing, and it's a lesion. It's actually, you know, a lesion type of healing. How much it'll go, how far, I don't know. And what the consequences eventually, I can't discuss right now, but gotta wait and see how much healing takes place, take over.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like fun. Growing old is not an easy process. It does beat the alternative, but just barely. Okay. Hope that all turns out well. Bye-bye, you all. I gotta leave you. See you guys down the log. K2RRW clear. Try to be kind to each other.
Okay. Take care, everybody.
Good night, Mel. Good night, Dick. Have a great new year. TC2WGB.
Good night, everybody. Thank you very much for today's conversation and to actually tell them we're going to give you a call.
Okay, Wes. Give me a minute to get in the house.
The time is 12:47 a.m. Date not set. amateur radio repeater system. Good morning. The time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30 W2VL repeater system.
That turned around and put things in a clock ticking for how long it was supposed to be for the city to remove the snow from the streets and make the streets passable, which is why they always play the game and they go, well, we cleared the streets where there's a school. Well, gee, school was closed last week. So why did you need to clean those streets first? Why didn't you clean the streets that, like, buses and trucks and cars need to go on instead of ones that school buses needed to go on?
Okay. Yeah, don't worry. He just hired somebody as a school chancellor that has no knowledge of education, was never in the educational field, but they become school chancellor. So, it's all politics. What can I tell you? So, I guess all the kids are back to school this week, right? Gary, over to you.
Yeah, everyone should be back to school. I don't know of any schools that are still out. And maybe some of the universities haven't started up yet, but we'll see. You know, Bloomberg's got some problems. He hasn't heard the last of this storm. And I wonder what the city smells like with all the garbage still on the street. They're first starting to pick up garbage today. Richie? Probably smells a little bit like an indoor Limark Hamfest.
Whoa, wait a second now. Okay. Yeah, I heard that this morning. I saw a guy jumps out of a ninth-story building out of his window to commit suicide, lands into a pile of garbage, and he lives. There you go. What a story. He's in critical condition, but he lived. Can't even do that right. Gary, over to you. N2EB.
Can you imagine psychologically what someone has to be like? They are so depressed or sick with life that they attempt to commit suicide by jumping out a window, land in garbage, live, and then they're going to get arrested for attempted suicide, which is illegal. So he's going to have a great psychological outlook. Richie? Not to mention that they're also going to probably get a ticket for littering, because I'm sure they broke a few bags when they hit.
Oh, he could always claim that the bags were broken when he saw just before he landed that the bags were already open. So, unless somebody saw it, the bags opening up while he hit. Yeah, there's a lot of legal things here.
How do you like that? I'm not sure exactly which community it was. It's Westchester, Yonkers, or something like that, where they were going around ticketing cars that had not been moved in 48 hours because there's a law that you have to move your car every 48 hours. Otherwise, it's considered abandoned. You're not legally allowed to abandon on the streets. And they were snowed in.